Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The View From Here. I'm your co-host, Jeff Milchin, along with Steve Kirchhoff.
Hello.
And our guests today are Bob Wall, who is the chief engineer and board president at KGVM Community Radio in Bozeman, along with Jody Housen, who served for many years as a reporter with the Bozeman Daily Chronicle, DJs at KGLT, amongst many other journalistic endeavors. So we're going to start off talking a little bit about KGVM Community Radio. And Bob, if you could start us off, we'd love to just hear about kind of the story of origin. What led you and other people to engage in getting KGVM off the ground, and what's the current status of the organization?
Sure. Well, thanks, Jeff and Steve, for inviting me to talk about this pet project. I guess it's grown past a pet project now, but the impetus for launching KGVM happened 12 or 13 years ago. There was a group of people here in Bozeman, in the Gallatin Valley, that really wanted to get Democracy Now! On the air in the Gallatin Valley. And so 12 years ago, a lot of people couldn't or didn't pull out their phone and pull up Democracy Now! On their phone and listen to it. If this had been happening now, it might be a whole different path. But they wanted to get Democracy Now! On the air, so they formed a nonprofit, Gallatin Valley Community Radio, and they started working to apply for an FCC license. And the group secured the assistance of a radio engineer out in Pennsylvania, somewhere near Philadelphia. He did a lot of the engineering work for them for very little money. And they submitted an application to the FCC, and it was accepted, I think, in around 2007. So they were ready to go. And then the place that they'd applied for the license to locate the transmitter, when you apply with the FCC, you have to tell them a lot of information about what you're going to do. And part of that was where the transmitter would be. And the place that they had planned to put the transmitter decided that they were going to get rid of that tower and they didn't want to be in the radio business anymore. So they had to, they gave up that application and decided they would start a new one. They would find a new place to put the tower. And they did that and went through the gyrations again, came up with a whole new plan, submitted the application, and it didn't go as well at that point in time. And it was 6 years in the making, waiting for the FCC to approve the license. And there were actually three or four other groups in the area that were vying for that same frequency. And it came down to Gallatin Valley Community Radio and one other group. And we went back and forth, and there were challenges to applications and counter challenges. And finally, at one point, we thought we were going to be given co-granted a license and we would have to timeshare it, which would have been interesting. But eventually the FCC decided, like 4 1/4 years ago, to grant sole access to the frequency to Gallatin Valley Community Radio. So by that point, it had been a long wait, and a lot of people had kind of drifted away. And so fundraising was more difficult than it might have been had it been a little more timely. So it took us, we had 3 years to get on the air by the FCC requirements from the grant of the license. And the deadline was the 13th of May in 2018. And we broadcast our first radio wave on the 11th of May in 2018. So it was close, but we managed to get on the air. It was a guerrilla operation, but we got everything up and running and have been growing it since.
So Bob, along with that interest in the specific program, Democracy Now!, a syndicated national daily news program for those who aren't familiar with it, what are some of the other motivations that the people who put energy into getting KGVM off the ground had in mind to accomplish here in the Gallatin Valley?
So I think, you know, after that kind of kernel of an idea took root, as more people started to get involved, obviously there are going to be a lot of different ideas that people are going to bring to the table and different passions and desires for where it might go. But I think it settled out into an agreement that we wanted to promote local things, and there were a lot of different things. News, views, arts were kind of the predominant ones. So there were people involved that were in the arts, music, poetry, visual arts as well, but you know, just an idea that the more people know about that, the easier, you know, the easier it is going to be for artists here. And then people that were interested in different aspects of local issues, and that, you know, there was certainly somewhat of a political aspect to it, but just I think a lot of the impetus was focusing on all of the different people here that are involved with so many different nonprofits and stuff, and how is there a vehicle to help make their lives easier, to get word out and to try to help people that might want to understand what's going on here find information more easily. And so those were the things that I think kind of helped guide the vision of what the station would be as we finally moved forward to getting it into, to make it a reality.
Great. So Jody, you do a show on KGLT radio. So coming from that perspective, what do you think about KGBM and how two different community radio stations will add to the overall media in the Gallen Valley?
Well, and just to name another radio station that does a fine job is Yellowstone Public Radio that we get here in the Valley. And Yellowstone Public Radio, subsidiary of National Public Radio, does a great job of reporting national and international news. And even YPR does a fairly good job of local news, but they can't cover the whole state. And they're based in Billings, so they tend to cover stuff that's east of us, doesn't really cover Southwest Montana very well. Mm-hmm. And that's not a cut on them, because they do a great job. But
it's kind of a big state to cover.
Yeah, it is a huge state to cover, and actually that's part of the point. I think local media is crucial to democracy and to people being informed and making informed decisions when they go to the polls. I mean, that's basically what it's all about. KGLT does the kind of the exact opposite of what I feel like KGBM is doing, which is that KGBM, I think, is serving as a great outlet for local news, local issues, local events and whatnot. And save for the public service announcements that we play on KGLT, our goal is to form a community around music and to give people an outlet to get away from the news that is so, you know, haranguing at times these days. So I think they both serve not a completely different purpose, but we're pretty much told that, you know, politics is not part of what we do at KGLT.
Yeah.
And we really are not supposed to get into that as DJs, which is fine, you know, because we're really there about the music and we love doing that. And I had a listener tell me last week that he can tell. So it's a blast. It's really, really fun. I think that
Absolutely.
Answers your question.
if I can kind of build on that. We had a lot of discussion when we were trying to decide what KGVM was going to be when it grew up or when it was born. There was a not insignificant amount of that discussion was around KGLT and KGVM and the relationship between the two, and whether we wanted to or didn't want to compete isn't quite the right word, but, you know, how we wanted to interact. And, you know, I've been a supporter of KGLT for a lot of years and love the station. So I think we became aware more and more all the time that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week it's an unbelievable amount of time when you actually have to make some noise in that time. So it was not, whether we wanted it to or not, it was not going to be all talk radio. And I didn't want it to be that, because I think people need a little bit of a kind of a mix up and stuff. So at this point, I think, you know, we're obviously playing music and we're still trying to grow our volunteer base. So we don't have the luxury of doing everything that we would like to, but we're certainly trying to move in the direction of focusing on local music. And I know KGLT does some of that. And I think, but some of the things that I think they used to do have kind of fallen off a little bit. Like I remember listening to when they used to have the bands in the sub, in the, you know, God, I can't remember what they called the show.
That's before my time.
Yeah, but you know, so I think we're trying to bring this really hyper local focus to the music part of it too.
Still do Live from the Divide.
Yes, yes. So you know, I think that you know, there's definitely room for both, and you know, one thing that I like, there are times when I turn on the radio, it's, you know, now it's turned to KGVM most of the time. It's like, well, whatever's on there right now is not catching my ear, so I turned to KGLT, right. And I think there's plenty of opportunity for that.
All right, well, let's talk about broadening it to the kind of the broader media structure here in Southwest Montana. So, Jody, you worked for many years reporting for the Chronicle, and would love to hear a bit of your background, maybe your journalism career prior to the Chronicle, and then what your experience with the Chronicle is. What should people know about what their local newspapers, whether that's the Chronicle or the Belgrade News or the Livingston Enterprise or the Boson, you know, any of the print media?
I'll tell you a little story about, so I came here from Maine, and that's where I started my journalistic career. And I was a regional reporter for one of the large dailies in Maine at the time. And in Maine, and especially in a lot of the small towns, they still have town meetings. And if you don't know what an actual town meeting is, it is the definition of democracy. It's amazing because the whole town gets together. Sometimes they hold them on a weekend, sometimes they hold them, but basically they have agendas where they go through all the line items on the budget. Not, you know, not line by line, but just the general, you know, fire department, whatever. And go through them, and they vote on them by a show of hands. And it was amazing. I mean, Kennebunk, which is a fairly good-sized town, was still holding town meetings when I was covering them. They later had to, I think, go to, so it's called selectmen. They had to go to a town council format because they couldn't find a place large enough to hold all the people. So that's, but what's really, really, it was really fascinating to me to see that when I was told I had to cover town meetings, and I'm not from Maine, so I didn't even know what that was. I just think it's a really cool thing. But what it also made me realize, as a journalist, that making errors in the newspaper is a really, really, I hated doing it, because what I realized, and especially now that I'm working on some stuff that involves doing research, and, you know, when somebody's going back and looking at archives or historical information, one of the things that you can use as a primary source, you know, within scholarly circles is considered newspapers, right? And there's this website called newspapers.com, and you can go on there, and they have archives, and the Library of Congress has archives. But the thing is, when you make a mistake in a print newspaper, it can get fixed. You know, now they're all online mostly, so, you know, it can get fixed. But if you're only looking at the old print newspapers, which when I was reporting in Maine, there really wasn't, we weren't online yet, and you know, gets printed as a retraction or you know, the errors on the front page, you know, inside of the front page, the second page of the paper, and nobody reads those, you know? And what they read is the stuff that's inside the paper, right? You know?
But that's challenging, because you're working on deadlines every day of the week,
correct,
right? So
correct.
There obviously has to be some kind of trade-off there between multiple rounds of fact-checking versus meeting the deadline.
Right, but what it pointed out to me, and what I knew before I even came out here, was that I knew I was writing history, you know? And so it was really, really important to me to be open-minded, and I've given this advice to younger reporters, younger journalists, you know, that to be open-minded and listen to what everybody had to say. And so I feel like that's a huge role that that media, and I mean that in the general sense, needs to serve. So I'll just read you. There was this woman back in 2011. Her name is Judy Muller. She published a book called Emus, Loose, and Egnar. And the book is all about these small daily newspapers. Am I jumping ahead here?
No, go right ahead.
Okay. And I'm just going to read you the first paragraph of her prologue in this book. This just in, journalism is not dead. It is alive and kicking in small towns across America thanks to the editors of weekly newspapers who, for very little money and a fair amount of aggravation, keep on telling it like it is. Sometimes they tell it gently, in code only the locals can understand. After all, they have to live here too. But telling it like it is also takes courage, as one tenacious editor in the Texas Panhandle discovered. Her coverage of politics and crime and the convergence of the two prompted some readers to express their editorial opinions with rocks and bullets. Like many of the gustier publications, her paper is a stand-tough, family-owned operation. And I'm just happy to read, I was so thrilled to read this book because she just went around to all these different places and looked at all these different small newspapers that, you know, they struggle. They have to live there, right? I just read an article on the Montana newspaper, Montana Press Association's newsletter. The Big Sandy Mountaineer was for sale, and Lori Merrill bought it earlier this year in the summer. And so she's a local. She bought the local newspaper, so it's privately owned. And Big Sandy's, I'm sure, not a big town. I can't remember. It's a 110-year-old newspaper, and she said that the Mountaineer needs to continue. It's an important tool for our community, and I thought it was important to be locally owned. And I love that, and I think that's what all of us need to be aware of, that it's challenging. You know, Bozeman no longer, I no longer consider Bozeman a small town, and, you know, it's clear that international reporters can get assaulted just coming to our town to report on a political story. So, and I'll just leave that at that. But, you know, it's not a glamorous career, and it doesn't pay well. I think even the reporters at NPR aren't making a ton of money. You know, we do it out of a love of country, a love of our communities, and a love of portraying the stories that need to be told.
And I think this is Steve Kirkhoff chiming in, and thank you for that, Jody, because for me, my concentration has always been on print media, just because I grew up with it. I always had a newspaper on my lap. I was in a household where we got the Great Falls Tribune in the morning, and we got the Bozeman Daily Chronicle in the afternoon, because it used to be an evening paper. And so that was what we had when I was growing up, and there were CBS, ABC, and NBC. So that was its own form of monopoly, right?
You forgot PBS, but that's okay.
the point being that for me, the Bozeman Daily Chronicle has always been the community bulletin board. It's a place where you know what's happening. It's a place that you find out what occurred, or at least you used to be able to find out what occurred at meetings of some kind of importance to you, whether it be a school board, the city commission, the county commission, those being the three principal ones, and the university and the hospital. If those are like the sort of the five legs of a five-legged stool that kind of makes up Bozeman's social economic profile, that's where you found out about those things, and that's where you decided if you wanted to go to a meeting or not. But I don't ever I never had the notion that the Chronicle had reporters of true grit who would tell the truth. I always thought the Chronicle was totally vanilla and was basically entrenched interest, and you could not read between the lines to get what I thought was important to me as a citizen. So that's, you know, when we lament the sort of decline in the number of outlets, we lament what's happened because of the sort of the growing megalopolies out there and the number of areas in our country that have basically gone media dark. Like, you talk about the ring cities around a metropolitan area like Chicago that are no longer reported on. There are no suburban reporters. They were having robo-reporters for some of those places. Some of those stories were getting written by people like in the Ukraine for like pennies on the story. I mean, what's happened to journalism is horrible, but what it was replacing wasn't grand.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so I guess the only note that I would put into this conversation is that we should not wax too nostalgic about the glory days of American press, because I don't know when those were exactly. I think it's always been a matter of, like, basically bourgeois interests, right? Because journalism has been capitalistic since at least the second decade of the 19th century. And that means that it's been mostly advertiser-supported, so that means it reflects the bourgeois sentiments of advertisers just of necessity. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do, but I'm gonna counter that, because first of all, as far as having grit, I will tell you that when I was the crime reporter at the Chronicle, I had a couple things happen to me. One, I had a rifle pointed at my right at me. I don't think my parents know this. Don't listen to me. But the other thing that I remember also as a crime reporter, the very first time that I sat down with Sheriff Jim Cashel, I said to him, look, I used to work in public safety. I was an EMT. I understand what you guys do. I'm not going to pretend that I understand everything that you guys go through. But I want to tell you something. I respect what you do, and I'll stay out of your way. But I'm also going to hold you to task. You know, I'm going to want to get the story. And if you screw up, I'm going to take you to task for it. I mean, I said this to the sheriff the very first time I met him. I'm like, don't think I'm going to go easy on you. I mean, but I had a great working relationship with him. So, I take deference to that comment about not having grit. Can I clarify just a little? Yeah, but I just have one other thing to say about that, though, because the other thing about the bourgeois thing, I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I think that's from an outsider's point of view. I never, ever saw our publisher, well, I shouldn't say never, ever, but very, very rarely saw our publisher. So the Chronicle, the building itself was kind of, there was no walls per se, but our one half of the building, actually two-thirds of the building was advertising and one-third of it was the newsroom. And we were on separate sides of the building. And the only time advertising came in to the newsroom is if they were, you know, dealing with layout issues or something like that. Or if they had a tip for us, you know.
Separation of ownership and editorial.
Absolutely. And that's, in my experience, and I've worked for four newspapers, in my experience, except for one, so it's not true all the time, I did not see a huge impact of corporate interest interfering with the news.
So what's your experience where there was that kind of intrusion into the editorial?
Oh, I don't know. If it was so long ago. I don't know that. That was when I was a regional reporter. So I just know that that newspaper had certain agendas that, you know, but I don't see that now. And so I don't know if that gives you any...
No. that doesn't dispel any of my deeply held convictions, because I'm 57 years old and I've been reading newspapers since I was old enough to read them. And with all due respect to you, which I do have great respect for, your grit, okay? That's not what I was talking about. I'm not talking about whether you're afraid or not of things, and I respect anyone who does their job and does their job well, including you. And I apologize for having made you think that I did not.
I didn't really think that you had
some kind of courage about things. But what I'm talking about is more just the economic interests that have always dominated this community. This is just my take on it, right? And I just don't believe that we still, to this day, we don't get. We get stories. I mean, the whole notion that we get read stories is kind of a fallacious way for us to think about how life works, because it doesn't really work that way. You know, I mean, it's like we have policies, we live within structures. We don't live within stories all the time. It's not just a matter of like a discrete thing happened on Monday night and now you know about it and make of it what you will, or don't make anything of it at all. There'll be another Monday night, another thing will happen, there'll be another story about it. There's no necessarily connectivity between events. There's no deep connection to the abiding interests of people for information so they can govern their lives.
I agree.
When I think about newspapers, what I think is what they're supposed to do in our democracies, they're supposed to equip us for self-rule. And I don't feel that happens, because we constantly get what Chomsky would call the manufactured consent, and the notion that you don't see advertising actually exerting an influence by somebody coming over or the publisher calling someone in and making him crawl on the carpet and you'll never make that story or mistake again. It's not transmitted that way. It's just transmitted by the entire vibe of the place. Everybody learns it when they're cub reporters.
Right.
And there are just certain things that are okay, and there are certain things that are not okay.
I never felt that at the Chronicle.
Yeah, well,
true. And I wouldn't argue.
I never felt that, and I was pretty experienced by the time I got there, so I never got that feeling there.
I was just going to say, I certainly wouldn't argue with that, you know, a person in your position, Jody, but I do think Steve's point makes a lot of sense. You know, when someone becomes a news anchor at Fox News,
they're
not getting a set of, here's what you can talk about and can't talk about.
No, and I absolutely,
everyone knows very well what the agenda
is. Yeah, and I absolutely, I'm just defending the Chronicle specifically, but I don't disagree with what you're saying in a general sense. Absolutely, I agree with you that there is definitely influence, and a lot of that, if you look at historically what's happened in Montana, the Anaconda Standard, I was just reading about this recently, I can't remember where I was reading about it, but all the newspapers in Southwest Montana were owned by the Anaconda Company, which was the mining company in Butte, right? And Anaconda and Twin Falls.
That was across most of the state, not just
exactly,
the West.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, it was owned by the Copper Kings. And so, yes, they did. And there was a really interesting... I wish I could have forgot all about that.
Except for the Great Falls Tribune.
That's true.
That's why it has such a great reputation across the state for so many years, because it stood up to Standard Oil.
Yeah, but... I'll just give you another example of something that a lot of people may not be aware of, but like when you hear NPR say something about what's her name? Ray Kroc's wife.
Joan.
Joan Kroc. So, thank you. Cut that out, too.
so now I don't have any choice.
So, Joan Kroc, when she passed away, and this was way back in the 80s or 90s, I think, or I don't know, it was a while ago, she bequested National Public Radio a bazillion, I don't know how much money, but a ton of money. If you don't know who Ray and Joan Kroc were, they were the founders, which he was the founder of McDonald's. And, you know, I mean, give or take McDonald's, you know, there's all kinds of things, but I think it's really interesting to know. And I don't think that NPR is trying to hide that fact. Because they're a nonprofit, you know, but they are taking corporate interest. So then you get into this whole thing about, okay, they always do say when they're reporting a story that such and such, you know, if it's about such and so, you know, a corporation or whatever, that they are a sponsor, a corporate sponsor of right. National Public Radio or Public Radio International, or whatever it is. So, I mean, I think that the other thing that newspapers and radio stations and whatnot are trying to do to make it more transparent what they're doing is they are providing you the actual documents. I mean, the other day when the whistleblower report came out, as soon as I heard that it came out, I was listening to NPR and I was listening to the Inquisition. It's not the right word.
Yeah, just...
Yeah.
the Judiciary Committee hearing.
Right, the hearing. I was listening to the hearing and... And then they said they cut in and said that and I went right to NPR's website and there it is, the actual document, you know, scanned in that I could read. Now, yes, people can, you know, now there's all kinds of ways that digital stuff, but I mean, it comes down to trust too. And I understand where your distrust is coming from, Steve. I'm not dismissing it at all, but here's the good news. The good news is that there are news organizations in the state that are not taking corporate dollars and are not taking advertising dollars, and they are being 100% supported by listeners and listeners only.
So that seems like a great cue to ask Bob about the organization of KGBM and your nonprofit status and what's your vision of how this station is going to become, you know, financially stable for the long term.
Well, I think that this is interesting because I mean a part of that is definitely going to be through underwriting, and I mean there are subtle differences, maybe not really that subtle differences between advertisers and underwriters, and those some of those differences are spelled out by the FCC, but you know we certainly anticipate that some portion of our funding is going to come from community organizations, whether they're businesses or nonprofits, that will support us in exchange for us mentioning what they do and how they do it and where to find out information. But I think that will be a component of it, but I think we're hoping that this community will support it. I think that as we move forward, we're going to be applying for grants, and I hope that we're successful and that we'll be able to obtain money. But that's interesting in light of the conversation we just had about, you know, where does that grant money come from? Some of that grant money comes from organizations that have supporters like we would have. Other grant money comes from organizations who are trusts that were formed from somewhere, and some of those might have some entanglement with people that had a lot of money, or Rockefellers or something, you know.
That's right.
So it's an interesting conundrum, and I think that I anticipate that we'll have a lot less trouble avoiding any kind of quagmires related to perception of entanglement. And I think that's important to think about. It's, I mean, actual entanglement is obviously problematic for a news organization in particular. And I'm not even sure in my own mind where I would like KGVM to go toward. But I would hope that as we get more involvement and a little more support, that we will be able to have some aspect of providing news or something like it to the community of a local content. You know, we're not going to compete with the Chronicle or with papers, but maybe we can help be complementary in some way to help people get information about what's going on and stuff. But, you know, I think that you really need to avoid the appearance of any kind of entanglements as well. And I think that the nature of how I anticipate that we're going to fund and grow is will lead us away from too much problem with that. So I think, you know, it's not clear to me like the different sources of grants and how successful. Maybe we'll get some big grants from some places that are far outside of our community or outside of our state. But I anticipate that a lot of our support is going to be local. Mm-hmm. And I want to, I think that that's a valuable thing. Just when we talk about trust, for better or worse, I think it's true that people are more likely to trust us as a source of information if they do believe that we are a local organization that's funded locally, that's supported locally. And like I say, for better or worse, because I think sometimes people, they might get perceptions about things that aren't necessarily reality. If we got a grant from an organization that was partially funded by a trust that was granted by an oil baron who passed away or something, does that mean that we're going to be pro-oil? No, it probably does not. But it might not matter if people get the impression that that's going to be true. So, but I don't anticipate we'll have too much worry about that, at least for quite a while.
Right.
I also think that you're already providing some of the services that you're talking about in terms of news. You know, you are going out and recording events, like you were telling me, Denison's talk the other day, the Country Bookshelf, but also the candidates forums and that sort of thing. So, you know, people don't want to go to the live performance, I was going to say.
Yeah.
If they don't want to go to that live event, they can still hear what the candidates have to say.
Right. You know, and I think that as we were trying to chart our course, you know, for all of those years that we were waiting on the FCC license, people, you know, there are a couple of people that have been involved with the station through that time that have done yeoman's work. And Steve Durbin was the chairman of the board and still, like, I was doing this show Wednesday night with an artist that came in the studio, and music is my passion, and so whenever I get a chance, I use that excuse to try to get out of doing anything else. And so I was like, well, I got this show to do. I'd already arranged. There were three events going on that we really wanted to cover, and it's like, man, I forgot. I scheduled this thing, so I can't help tonight. And Steve is like, that's okay. I think I could do probably two or maybe of them. So he'll go set up someplace, plug a recorder in, start it going, and then walk down to the next one, plug the next recorder in, then walk back and get the first one when it's done. And so he's been doing things like that for years. And so we had this kind of stockpile of that kind of recordings of events and stuff that people could just go to the website and grab whenever they want. And we still are trying to do that. So I think that that's an important part of it. It's like you said, being a kind of an archivist and a historian of things and making that stuff available, because with the amount of things that are going on in Bozeman now, you can't go to all of the things that you might be interested in, right? So I hope that we can in some way help to fill that gap. And like I said, it's radio, so we don't know how many people are out there listening. Right. But, you know, the ones that aren't listening, if they can go and get it off the website at a later point, and if that helps in some way inform them, help them make decisions, let them know what's going on, I think I feel pretty good about what we've done. So
So this seems like a great opportunity to mention, first of all, you're listening to KGVM in Bozeman. And secondly, for people who might be thinking, well, I'd be willing to go out to some of the talks I attend and record or place some other role in helping the station in some other way beyond contributing financially. What are some of the ways people can learn about opportunities to get involved, Bob?
So we have our website, kgvm.org, has some information on it about, you know, ways to contact us and opportunities and stuff. And I think we're working on improving that information and consolidating it a little better so people can do that. We recently moved into this studio space here in the basement of the Labor Temple, and the lead up to that and stuff was chaotic a little bit and it occupied everybody's attention. So we had been doing kind of monthly station meetings, and we have kind of suspended them, and we haven't really started those. But if people are interested, I think we do have a meeting every Friday of the board and the and some of the volunteers, and people are welcome to attend those.
Every Friday.
We were every Friday. I guess we're switching back to every other Friday now, because after the move and some of the busy things that were going on this summer, it was like, well, we had plenty to talk about. But
and for people who may not have had any experience with radio but like the idea of getting involved, doing a show like this, sure, or playing music, what are the opportunities for them to learn how to do that?
So we have every the first Wednesday of every month, so
next week?
This next Wednesday will be, we have a DJ training. We call it a DJ training. It's not specific to DJs. It's really for anyone who wants to do something that we would put on the air. And it's mostly going through the FCC regulations and some of the related requirements and do's and don'ts and stuff. And once people do that, if they're interested and they get through that, then we've got, it's certainly a not nearly as rigorous as the process that KGLT has, but we do have kind of apprentice opportunities for people to come in and kind of watch somebody do a show and find out the ins and outs. So those, you know, that's the place to start. We, you know, if anybody who's interested, if they just email info@kgvm.org, say, hey, what are some things that I could do? You know, I'd like to get involved, and we can kind of go from there. But we do have some of those standard things like the DJ training, first Wednesday of every month here at the station at 6:30 p.m. And there, you know, there are a ton of other things. And one of those things, if there are people that do like to attend events and stuff and wanted to have a quick course on how to set up a recorder and do it, that would be great, because like I said, there are more events going on than we can handle, and we would love some help with that. And
great.
And then helping to, like, somebody comes back with their recorder full of audio, and somebody's got to sit down and like run it through an editor and kind of clean it up and get everything ready to go. And we've got a lot of that. That would be a great thing for people to do. So.
All right.
I think you're teaching, when you just to answer the thing about KGLT's rigorousness, the difference is that we have to do everything, and we're doing it live. And so we have to learn how to use the board and all the different. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a completely different thing. And I mean, I think what you can offer people, which I think is really cool, and I would even be interested in getting back into it. I did a few pieces for Maine Public Radio back when I was living in Maine. So I did everything from recording and writing the narrative and doing all that. But, so I do know, I have had experience editing audio, but I don't know if I remember how to do it. And so I would love to get back into doing stuff like that. I just think that's a really lot of fun. And that's not something that's, not that it's not available at KGLT, but it's not something that we learn as apprentices.
I think it's really interesting. Like in this day and age, it's funny. I went down to Music Villa to see about getting some equipment for in the studio, and they had this microphone. I'm like, wow. I was sort of surprised that Music Villa would have a microphone that's typically used in radio studios. It was great, because that's exactly what I was hoping to find. But I was like, wow, I'm surprised. And do you guys often have these? Like, we have them all the time, and they disappear like hotcakes. And I was really surprised. Podcasters buy them. Mm-hmm. And so there are all of these people that are putting together podcasts. And I think that that's a fantastic thing. But if we kind of like try to bring things back around to what what a local newspaper or a local radio station can offer. The thing that I think is so important is that if the, you need someone that you can trust to help you curate, because there's too much stuff. And I don't have time to spend that much of my day trying to figure out where the great things are. And I would like to defer some of that to someone else that I could trust to do that. And I think, you know, we tiptoed around that a little bit, but we need to convince people that either their local media can be trusted or help them make that true. And, you know, monetization and funding models for media so that they don't have to be so dependent on influences that might not help that along. I think that's a part of it. This is just kind of this discussion I've been having with a lot of people lately about media, music, and other things, how, you know, consumers of those things maybe have kind of lost track of the fact that there are people out there that if you want them to do that, if you want to be able to trust them, that needs to be their job, and they need to be able to sustain themselves doing that job. Like you said, a lot of them, and, you know, whether you're a journalist or a musician, most of you that are doing that are not going to get rich. You're not going to get anywhere
close
to rich.
Depends on your definition of rich.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're doing it as a labor of love, and so we need to, you know, help people understand that and help convince them that they need to, if they value that, they need to take part in it. They need to be willing to support it, and that support isn't just yay. It's fish out your wallet and be willing to subscribe at a level that's going to be meaningful. Like, you know, not just a token. Yeah, I subscribe to Spotify. You know, I pay $10 a month. There's not one artist that's not going to starve to death on that. So, you know, I think we just need to help people understand the importance of that. It, you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm just really super naive, but, you know, hopefully if people do understand that and are willing to do that, then places like your local media, they really are curators of this avalanche of information. They can help you sort it out, and they can fill in the information that isn't going to come from anywhere else. Like the local information, it's got to come from here.
I'm dying to tell this story. Steve, I know, first, you're just so quiet, and I don't want to take up all of your time if you have things to say, because I saw you taking notes, but I just have to tell a story. Some of you may have heard this story before, but back in 2010, there's this little town of Bell, California, that was 90% Latino. It was one of the poorest cities in LA County, about 20 minutes south of LA, I believe. And it was a town of 36,000 people. So what's Bozeman now? About that, right?
Almost
50, okay. Yeah. So it's a little bit smaller, but that's what it was, I think, when I moved here. Probably was about 40,000 when I moved here, right? Anyway, their officials were making, well, their town manager, city manager, was making $800,000 a year, and their police chief was making $450,000 a year, which was 50% more than the LA police chief or the LA County sheriff. Nobody knew that this was going on. And this was happening over a period of maybe 5 years or so. I'm not exactly sure, but the point is that there was no newspaper in that town, and the LA Times at the time, there was an older guy. His name was Arnold Adler, 73-year-old guy who was covering. He had a small newspaper, but he was covering 15 cities, including Bell. And he was kind of, and it was a small weekly, so, you know, just like all these other weeklies, there were maybe three reporters, tops. You know, he barely had time to cover that. There are 88 cities in LA County, by the way. Basically, what was happening is these city commissioners, nobody was watching the city, and they kept upping and upping and upping their salaries, and nobody was paying attention. And nobody wanted to talk about it. Even the people that were living there didn't even want to talk to the press, because, like, some of them were living in public housing and they were afraid of retribution, getting thrown out of public housing.
Yep, good testament to the importance of having local media.
Local and untethered.
Right. And one of the things that I think is interesting to explore is as it becomes tougher and tougher for smaller newspapers to exist because of online advertising basically drying up a huge portion of their revenues. Is there a viable way to provide that kind of accountability in smaller communities that maybe maybe it's not realistic to support a commercial daily newspaper anymore? What else can serve in that capacity?
Well, I have an answer. I just want to finish the story, though, because what ended up happening is that 8 officials were arrested. I didn't get that far into the story to find out how many of them were actually convicted. But the city manager, Robert Rizzo, was given 12 years in prison and ordered to pay $8.8 million in restitution to the city. And that's because there was no newspaper there. So if that's not a cautionary story, I don't know what is. And that story came via the LA Times, which sort of stumbled upon the story. They won Pulitzer Prizes for this coverage. But it just goes to show you that without, you know, the media covering local news, stuff like that happens, you know. The judge, and I love this quote, the judge Kathleen Kennedy said, there were no checks and balances to control Mr. Rizzo, those that were in power in the city. That's what she said in sentencing him, because he was hoping to get 5 years, and she's like, no way. but to answer the question about how, and I don't know how it's working, but it does seem to be working, is that there's a great example of a nonprofit newspaper in the state. It's sort of statewide, called the Montana Free Press, that John Adams, who is an icon of the newspaper industry here in Montana. He covered the Capitol for many years for, I believe, the Helena IR, or Independent Record. So he started that newspaper a few years ago, and it's nonprofit, and they need support. Even The Guardian, by the way, is asking for money, you know, just The Guardian in England.
So Jody, when you say the newspaper, are you talking about, is this appearing in print,
the Free Press? It is an online only, and they do a really good job, and they've even gotten collaborations with organizations like the Society of the Solutions Journalism Network, where they've produced two sets of stories, one about rural development and one about mental health services in the state. They produced, I can't remember, something like 60 stories that was based on a grant that they got through the Solutions Journalism Network, which is a international organization, I should say. So they're doing great things.
I think that one of the beauties of stations like KGVM is that they can help by doing their own journalism. And that's a gigantic ask to have of anybody who wants to just volunteer and have a radio show, to also be an investigative reporter, to, you know, inquire at whatever the powers might be in your community, and to keep inquiring and then come out with something. But this is one of the great things about democracy, is that there are channels, right? There is spectrum available for people who want to start an alternative to what's going on in their communities, and there is the potential for some pressure coming upward, right? Because I would consider us to be the people, and the people start to put some pressure on the community by providing more information, which is sort of like transgressive in a certain sense, because it's not coming through the standard channels, right? You're doing it on your own, but you're providing something that is hopefully A, accurate, B, truth-seeking, C, you know, double-checked, and then that's something that filters up into people's homes and people's households and people's thoughts. And if you can help to educate the people, which I believe is the purpose of journalism, is to educate people about what's happening in their communities so that they can have a stronger voice in the exertions of power, so that whoever is leading the community is actually in more accord with what the people actually want and believe. I mean, that's one of the purposes of this station. And if we could do that to the Chronicle, if we could do that to local TV, if we could do that to local radio, we'd be performing a huge service. Of course, that is a little that's a little high-minded, right? To think that we could do that kind of sort of hard-hitting analytical stuff about what's happening in our community. But I guess that would be sort of like my furthest reach. if I had like a big reach for what KGVM would be, not necessarily that I'm the one to do it, but that this station could collectively, through all its programming, have that kind of an impact on the community.
You know, I think you do make a good point, though, and that's just going back to talking about newspapers and the Chronicle in particular. But even newspapers. I was just reading a story this morning about, and I can't remember what newspaper was, about how they were going about doing these hard-hitting, deep dives into whatever events were going on in their communities. It's really, really tough with newsrooms shrinking. Because what people don't understand, I mean, other than, you know, whatever inherent dangers come along with being a journalist these days, there's, or just, you know, whatever, but it takes so much work to get. I mean, I remember there were things that I wanted to dig into when I was a reporter, but when you're working with a daily deadline and you've got to turn in a story every single day, you don't have the, you know, you have to try to find time to carve out. And some of the larger newspapers, even the LA Times, is finding it hard to find the space because their newsrooms have shrunken. How do you find time to just say, okay, I'm going to set this reporter free from doing daily tasks so that they can report?
What are some of the examples of kind of successful grassroots initiatives that we might look at for solutions to some of these challenges? I know some of you have some experience with regional media in Montana.
Well, we've already mentioned the Free Montana Press.
Montana Free Press.
Excuse me, yeah. Montana Free Press as an example of an alternative. And also, more even closer to home is the Mountain Journal, which is being led by our good friend Todd Wilkinson. And apparently, this online zine, which is journalistic in nature, which is focused on what would you call that focus?
Environmental
issues and environmental reporting, has as many hits on its digital website as the Chronicle does, and yet it's still searching for a viable sort of economic support system to keep people employed, to reward people for their hard work. So alternatives are cropping up against the odds. And what I think is beautiful about these alternatives getting legs and growing and springing up is that ultimately, in a democracy, what you need to do is have the people become the authority in a certain way, right? To the extent possible. Obviously, we're going to elect officials who are going to make decisions for us. Obviously, companies are run by individuals and boards of directors that are a tiny minority of the employees and the investor base. But still, in our mind's eye, I think we want to disintegrate the classic notions of authority with things like FM radio stations, which are non-commercial and locally based, which have voices of people that you know and recognize, and which can help the community to coalesce around objectives and goals and things that communities want to achieve.
And perhaps that's one of the bright spots in what we've seen in recent years of many disappearing local newspapers and other media outlets, is that in its place we can grow perhaps not outlets with as large a reach for any single one, but growing up many different points of view, and perhaps it will be online and on radio rather than in print, but to provide that kind of diverse viewpoint as well as the locally rooted viewpoints that we've lost in many communities.
I think that's a good point and a good goal. And I think, you know, a word that often would be thrown out to describe what you said is democratization of it, right? And so I think, you know, I think sometimes it's easy to lose sight of this, but when you're talking about local things like the Chronicle, sure, not everybody can be a reporter, but it is true that at least you can go see the reporters walking around on the street, and you can go talk to them. You can go challenge them about things and stuff.
Just as long as you don't body slam them.
Right, exactly. You know, don't assault them.
Unless you're seeking an elected position.
but if you know, I think that some of these grassroots things, like I think KGVM's got the opportunity to be this, is it's even more democratic because not only can you go and maybe talk to the people that are being involved, if you've got the bandwidth, you can be the person that's involved. And if you've got something to say and the time and the energy, come here and say it. And, you know, we're going to have to draw some boxes around what you can and can't say. You know, we have to operate within some rules and stuff. But still, you know, I think, and in my mind, that's a conjunct to the locality thing. But that democratization, making everybody feel like they have the opportunity to get involved with it is going to make it a lot more viable to them. I think they'll be a lot more likely. You said this also, that they're a lot more likely to trust it if they feel like they can reach out and touch it. And if they need to, they can reach out and push it and try to change its direction if they don't like the direction it's going. And so maybe that is a hope for like resurrecting. The availability of journalism is hurting, I think, you know, and so maybe that's a way to help that.
Right. And actually, you know, that you bring up a good point, because I was earlier reading a story and there was a report in March by the Pew Institute for Research or the Pew Research Institute that said that most Americans believe that local news media are doing well financially, but few pay for it. And they actually cited some statistics, and it was a very large survey that they did. And they said that 71% of the people that they surveyed believed that their local news media was doing well, whereas only 14% of those same people were paying for their local news.
And when was the survey?
This was just this past March.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of that is the responsibility of our current CEO of the country. because this person continues to say that journalists are elites, whereas journalists are working people, just like those that go to his rallies, and yet he's constantly maligning them as elitist because he's only talking about the talking heads on CNBC and CNN and etc. But journalists are working people. They're blue collar. It's a blue collar job. If you look at, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's often a thankless task. So that's a gigantic misrepresentation. And what we're talking about is trying to get across viable information, real information, genuine information in the sense of trying to educate ourselves, be educated by others, so that we have a robust way of like interacting with our life, and we're no longer so passive. And we actually take action because we're confident, because we know other people. The linkages are made in our communities that they become larger, and we sort of become more unified. That's what I think is part of this too.
I wonder, it's shameful the degree to which the individual one has has tried to actively get people to distrust reputable news sources. But could there be some kind of blessing in disguise that comes out of that, of leading more and more people to look to people they know, their local media, rather than putting faith into the large national organizations? Is there a potential upside here?
But speaking of which, another little statistic that I found in the Pew Research Center back in December 2018, and this is horrifying, so this is horrifying to me. More people in the U.S. as of December 2018 now get their news on social media sites instead of print newspapers, compared to 2016, so over a period of 2 years, when print surpassed social media. In 2017, it was about equal. 2018, social media surpassed print news. Now, print news, they're saying. Yeah. News websites and radio are increasing in popularity, they're saying. So I think what it points to is the fact that maybe print needs to start thinking of a new model. And I know, having worked in the print media for so long and in that period when the internet started to take over, that newspapers really do start to be thinking like John Adams, like Martin Kidston, who was laid off from the Missoulian, who started the Missoula Current, which is not a nonprofit newspaper, but it is an online newspaper that's covering the Missoula area. And Todd Wilkinson and John Adams, who are doing the hard work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's so many layers of this onion. When you start looking at it at the local level, part of the thing it seems to me that would help is maybe, and maybe this is a misperception on my part, but it seems to me like the basic concept of community and involvement in community is taken a whopping. And because of that, I think it just makes it a lot easier for people to retreat and to crawl into their little echo chamber, and to, you know, if you're isolated from other people, it's pretty easy to avoid things that you don't want to hear. If you have to get involved with other people, you know, it's inevitable that you're going to have some cross-pollination. Right. So, you know, I think part of the thing, when you talk about like a community radio station, is the community part of that is a, you know, maybe the most significant piece of that, I think. Mm-hmm. And are there things that we can do to help to help nurture community. And if we do that, does that help? Does that just help the whole process of trying to disseminate information get better?
Yeah, well, for me, I think this is one part of community building. The major part of community building, maybe this is not, but maybe, I don't know, could be. I don't think that you're actually making community with other people unless you can smell their breath. And like, it's impossible for you to help someone build a garage or a barn or to take down a barn on your electronic device. It's impossible for you to watch your neighbor's child using your device. It's impossible for you to know to bring some casserole to someone's grieving family. Well, no, you can know that with your device, but you can't beam it over there with your device, right? It's still not a Star Trek world.
Yeah.
And so I feel like some of this has to come down to disciplining our devices.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like to think that, oh, because the device is now all consuming of the human being's attention, that we need to find a way to make the device work for us and our democratic goals of education and community building. I don't know if that might be a false hope.
I think it is.
I think that those devices are more often they're just mirrors for like a disgusting kind of narcissism than they are for community building.
That's true.
You know what I'm saying?
You know, we hear a lot of talk these days about polarization in the country, and a lot of that is nonsense when, you know, the overwhelming majorities of people in the country are for things that our politicians are certainly doing the opposite of when it comes to serving corporate interests rather than public interests. But when it comes to kind of personal political polarization, I think that human interaction is the antidote to it, to avoid seeing the people who disagree with you political as enemies. What that really is thriving on is people becoming more and more disconnected, driving into their garage without ever even walking in the front door and seeing their neighbors in the house next door. We need those kind of community interactions to make us recognize that we're all Americans first, and we have far more in common than we do in opposition to each other.
I think that's really interesting, this, you know, community radio station. But I agree. I mean, the thing that we could do that forms community isn't the thing that's going out over the air. It's the people that we get to come in to help put that out, first and foremost, in my mind. We get more and more people that will actually come together to help do that. That's the community that we're forming. And then we're sending those things out over the airwaves to let people know about stuff in the hopes that they will get together and be a community. I agree. I mean, yeah, there's only so much we can do with a podcast to connect people. There's, whether we like to admit it or not, and maybe this is changing faster than I think it is, but we are wired for connecting with a lot of physical cues and a lot of physical aspects of our interaction that there's no replacement for yet. And to pretend that we can record something and beam it out there over a device or a radio waves or whatever, and that's going to somehow serve the same purpose and get to the same end is pretty, we're really kidding ourselves. So, but that's my hope, is that somehow the things that we can help disseminate, things that do facilitate actually getting people up off their couches, out of their houses to go do things together. And like I said, maybe this is naive, but it just seems like that's really gone a lot drastically the other direction. And the ill effects of that are probably too numerous to count. So,
Bob, I wanted to ask, I know that the reach is global on the internet, but in terms of the radio signal of KGBM, how wide a range can folks tune in?
I just had a guy in yesterday that's thinking about doing a show, and he lives over in Emigrant, and he's kind of up on the bench out there, and he said, I was driving in, I was listening to it. When I dropped down off the bench for a while, I couldn't hear it, and then I could again, so there's people over in Livingston can hear it.
So wait, he's living on the bench behind Emigrant? And he's just tired of listening to the Angels?
Apparently.
Okie dokie.
Or, you know.
And I've heard
dude, that's in one ear.
Yeah. Reach.
You know, we're out there most of the way to Butte.
Right.
And like we were driving uptown and went over through Boulder. And we were getting quite a ways up the valley there and still hearing it. So Townsend.
Great. Wow. Really?
Townsend, that's exciting.
Yeah.
No, I mean, so you can tune in at a large chunk of Southwest.
The reach is bigger than we expected. Yeah. So.
Steve, you have some words to share as we move toward the conclusion of our program?
I think Thomas Jefferson's always appropriate as a source to quote. He famously said regarding journalism, education of the people, and the robustness of democracy, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. But I should mean that every man should receive those papers and be capable of reading them."
You're here.
Wise words. And I'm sure if he were around today, he would be talking about radio being part of that importance in the media equation, too.
He'd be leading the Twitter blitz.
Oh, my God. Oh, please.
Well, thank you so much to Bob Wall and Jody Housen for joining us here today.
Thanks, Bob and Jody.
Yeah, thank you for
having
us.
Thanks for KGBM for putting up with us.
Right. And thank you all for listening to The View from Here on KGBM 95.9 in Bozeman.